Each year, it's my privilege to offer a contemplation that summons the memory and spirit of Larry Levis to this celebration. And this year, in the midst of an unprecedented, ugly, and frightening national election, my brief essay about a poem by Larry Levis focuses on the qualities of compassion and political awareness in it, as well as on its generosity towards women and towards marginalized people who are poor in wealth and in power, but not in spirit. May that be a comfort to us all. The essay is titled, Before It Gets Dark. If I were to swing a small chain in front of you tonight, as if I were a hypnotist attempting to put all of you under a spell, and if you saw that chain had a small cross dangling on the end of it, and if the cross seemed to have a man grasping onto its crossbar, much as if that man were swinging on a somewhat unlikely trapeze, you would now be seeing the central image of the poem by Larry Levis, which I'm going to discuss this evening. The man holding onto the trapeze would be an image of excitement and hope, as well as of tragedy and perhaps even comedy. The cross itself is, of course, a powerful symbol, one never to be taken lightly. And yet for former altar boys raised in the Catholic Church, as Larry Levis and I were, and I believe that group also includes Ricky Laurentiis, the cross can be a symbol that raises mixed feelings, a strong concoction of emotions that might include both awe and resentment, and not only a sense of altruistic idealism and spiritual yearning, but also a confrontation with disappointment and a not insignificant dose of suspicion. Perhaps that mixture is always there in association with all powerful symbols, whether it's an American flag pin on someone's lapel or it's a silver cross hanging around someone's neck. That flag pin and that silver cross may be symbols of strength and loyalty and affirmation, or they can become symbols of oppression and false advertising and abuse of power. And so they may well be objects suitable for wary, cautious responses, or even suitable for mockery, depending on who is wearing them and why. The poem by Larry Levis, Elegy with a Darkening Trapeze Inside It, provides the title for the posthumous volume of Levis poems, edited by his good friend David St. John, a new collection which has now entered the world since the last time I spoke at this annual Levis Reading Prize celebration. There are many reasons why this poem makes a great title poem and contributes as well to the book's strong title, The Darkening Trapeze, Last Poems. Part of it has to do with that image of a trapeze growing dark, as if the circus is closing down. Or perhaps the trapeze artist has fallen and the spotlight has been turned off. And part it has to do with one of the statements appearing in the poem. It marked the end of things. In fact, the poem begins with an image of frustration, entanglement, and stasis, a cartwheel stuck in mud. And it describes two loudmouthed sexist braggarts in a tavern who are drinking suica together. That's a kind of Romanian plum brandy or moonshine. And the two are boastfully recalling their one accomplishment in life, the seduction of a virgin beneath the now empty pedestal where a statue of the mad dog dictator Joseph Stalin had once stood. The poem's beginning certainly puts one in mind of another pair of sexist braggarts caught on videotape on a bus who are currently in our national news. Thus, the poem begins with a sadly depressing proof that the state is an old man's withered arm, a portrayal of a nation deflated, weakened, and without energy. The poem turns from the removed and discarded statue of Stalin to Karl Marx, who, the poem tells us, is the only surviving son of Jesus Christ, establishing a relationship between Marx and Jesus, which is further emphasized by the image presented of that last letter in the name Marx, that X, which the poem shows us as resembling an overturned cross on a windswept hillside. Marx, the poem suggests, announced the end of something, presumably industrialized capitalism. Yet the poem also points out an irony. The problem with a good idea is that it has to work. And Marx, the poem further suggests, has now become only marginally relevant. Both Christ and Marx are seen as figures who remind us of unrealized possibilities and hopes that have not been achieved, that have come to an endpoint of enervation, possibly failure. Christ is figuratively presented as a hapless acrobat waiting for a trapeze to come to him, but the empty bar that someone was supposed to swing to him did not arrive, and so his outstretched flesh itself became a darkening trapeze. The conceptual foundation of this poem by Levis is clearly a kind of echo of the famous poem by William Butler Yeats, The Second Coming, a poem written in 1919 at a historical moment quite similar to our own, as one century turned fully into another, and whose underlying conceptual framework is also highly appropriate to our troubled present, since Yeats also is writing about an historical moment that marked the end of something. Yeats is writing about the oncoming end of a 2,000-year cycle, a moment in the great cycle of spiritual and cultural changes when one dispensation, say, the domination of Christianity in Western civilization, is coming to an end, and a new dispensation, something unpredictable and quite dangerous, is coming into being, a rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouching toward Bethlehem to be born. The Levis poem does not simply end on a note of despairing resignation, however. Even though it does offer a portrait of economic and political injustice and chaos, as it describes the men Levis worked with in the vineyards of Central California where he grew up, men who were paid in wages thin as water, cash that evaporated and rose like heat. In addition, we encounter a bruja, a soothsayer, a palm reader in the migrant workers' camp who sadly cannot predict anything because her only answer to questions is to weep. And finally, we have the sketch of a woman, possibly the same woman, who is overcome by remembering her diminishment and pain from her time working in a grinding shed where her health was destroyed by inhaling steel filings. Yet the poem, in its last moment, balances the idea that it is too late to change things now with the possibility that it isn't. That may be the very idea that is referred to at the very beginning of the poem, the idea of a possible transformation or revolution that has gotten stuck in the mud, unable to progress. But by the end, though there is no simplistic solution or triumph in the poem, there is an affirmation of possibility. In fact, we have the example of the entire poem itself, which in its ability to look carefully at people and at ideas that are being so coldly pushed aside, nevertheless, at the same time, enacts a generosity and concern that may be in itself the basis of all hope and change. Even if fact is disbelief and death inescapably comes for us all, it is still possible that it is not too late to change things now. It may be possible to take one more ride on the big waves off the famous San Onofre surfing beach in California, even if only in imagination, just as it may be possible to take one last swing on that darkening trapeze. And with that introduction in mind, here is Larry Levis's poem, Elegy with a Darkening Trapeze inside it. The idea turned out to be no more than a cartwheel stuck in mud, an unturned field spreading to the horizon, while two guys in a tavern went on drinking tsuika and recalling their one accomplishment in life, the seduction of a virgin on the blank pedestal of a statue where Stalin had once stood. The state is an old man's withered arm. The only surviving son of Jesus Christ was Karl Marx. You can tell by the last letter of his name, which has the shape and frail balance of an overturned cross on a windswept hillside. It marked the end of things, of lumber that rots and falls. The czar is a shattered teacup. The trouble with a good idea is that it has to work. The only surviving son of Jesus Christ survives now mostly in English departments. and untended graves. One thing he said I still remember, a thing that's never there when I try to look it up, was sex should be no more important than a glass of water. It sounded vaguely like the kind of thing Christ might have said if Christ had a sense of humor. The empty bar that someone was supposed to swing to him did not arrive, and so his outstretched flesh itself became a darkening trapeze. The two other acrobats were thieves. My colleague Otto Fick, who 20 years ago wrote brilliant lectures on the air, sometimes would pause and seem to consult notes left on a podium and then resume. A student once went up after class to look at them and found only a blank sheet of paper. Nothing there. In theory, I believe in Marx, Otto said. In fact, my wife has to go in next week for another biopsy. Fact is disbelief. One day it swells up in front of you, the sky, the sunlight on everything, traffic, kids on surfboards waiting for the next big set off San Onofre. It's all still there, just there for someone else, not for you. This is what my friend Otto told me as we drove to work. I worked with men in vineyards once who were paid in wages thin as water, cash that evaporated and rose like heat. They lived in rows of makeshift sheds the owner hauled into an orchard too old to bother picking anymore, and where at dusk a visible rushing hunger raced along the limbs of the trees surrounding them. Their kids would watch it happen until a whole tree would seem to vanish under it. There were so many of them. By then, the rats were flying over a sickening trapeze of leaves, and the tree would darken suddenly. It would look like brown water rushing silently and spreading everywhere before it got dark anyway, and the kids went in. There was more rats in there than there was beads on all the rosaries of the dead. We went to confession all the time then, because we thought we might disappear under them trees. There was a bruja in the camp, but we didn't go to her no more. She couldn't predict nothing, and she'd always cry when you asked her questions. A woman said, who had stayed there for a while, "Every revolution ends, or it begins, in memory. Someone remembering her diminishment and pain, the way her scuffed shoes looked in the pale light, how she inhaled steel filings in the grinding shed for 30 years without complaining once about it, how she might have done things differently, but didn't, how it is too late to change things now, how it isn't."